This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. Lawmakers discuss several bills around opioid abuse and prevention this session, including the Opioid Reduction Act, and have reexamined the state's medical marijuana law. Michael Brummage is the new director of the West Virginia Office of Drug Control Policy. Health reporter Kara Lofton talked to him last week about the role his office plays in implementing legislative policy.
So you are the new director of the Drug Control Policy Office. Previously, you were executive director and health officer of the Kanawha-Charleston Health Department. Mm-hmm. You did deal with a lot of opioid issues at the health department previously. Will your strategy change in this new position?
Well, I think some of my philosophies that I had when I was in my previous position at the Kanawha-Charleston Health Department will stay the same. But obviously, it's a lot different dealing with a community level and a county level than it is looking at an entire state level. So, for instance, in my previous job, I did not have any jurisdiction over treatment or recovery beds, things like that, where we interacted, but it's a lot different now. So in this new position, I'm kind of in a coordinating position among all the different bureaus in the Department of Health and Human Resources, and I work directly for the Secretary, Bill Crouch. And so I'll be coordinating with all those different organizations within DHHR, those different bureaus, but also working with community groups across the state and with healthcare organizations. So there's a lot of different contingents I'm going to be working with in my new position that I did not have to do in my prior position.
Recently, we've been hearing Mayor Danny Jones making noises about getting rid of the needle exchange program in Charleston, and I know that was one of your pet projects. Talk to me a little bit about, kind of as you're leaving that position, what your reaction is.
Well, first of all, that is a program that has actually succeeded in what it was intended to do. So for the first time in 2017, the hepatitis B and C rates in Kanawha County fell, as did the overdose death rate, which is really encouraging news. The mayor and the chief of police have very legitimate concerns about the number of needles in our environment. That was always a problem, but it seems to have gotten worse recently. We want to be a part of that solution. There's also the concern about bringing people in from out of town and having them go through Charleston, disrupting businesses, and which is really a major issue. So what we would like to do is to be able to continue to run the syringe service program. I'd like to see it continue after I leave, but by tweaking the policies, procedures, and by collaborating with city officials to help clean up some of the syringes and work it so that we can have people go elsewhere. And now we know that there is a statewide harm reduction coalition, and there's 14 different programs across the state, five new ones popping up. So people will have options of going closer to home, whereas before, Charleston and Huntington were really their only options in this part of the state.
I know that one of the initiatives you took on to try to combat the needle is like in the parks and playgrounds was to put a bear box outside of the Kanawha-Charleston Health Department. Was that successful?
It was. So in the first week, we had a 38-gallon drum that was inside of that bear box filled up with needles. And so we didn't even count those among our return needles. So far, that program has actually had 2 tons of needles returned to it over time. Of course, we've also given out a lot of syringes too, to be fair.
This session, there have been several bills discussed in the legislature about opioids and trying to combat the epidemic. Do you think that these efforts will make a difference in the fight against against the epidemic in West Virginia?
Yes, I definitely do. The opioid reduction bill that went through the legislature to limit the number of opioids prescribed, I think, is one good example of that. And that really was attempting to conform practices in West Virginia of prescribing opioids with the CDC's opioid prescribing guidelines. And I think many aspects of that bill have passed through, from my understanding, and they will make a difference over time. We need, when the sink is overflowing, as somebody told me yesterday, what's the first thing you do? Well, you turn off the faucet. And so this is an attempt to turn off the faucet.
This is a relatively new office for the DHHR. What is the real purpose of the office, and what do you hope to accomplish in it?
What I hope to be able to do is to help implement the opioid response plan that Dr. Gupta actually spearheaded, and it's a really robust response plan that deals with things like access to medication-assisted treatment. Harm reduction is one of those pillars, and a lot of good recommendations that came from that. And the process by which that was developed was actually very robust. They include two different public comment periods and brought in a set of experts from Johns Hopkins, West Virginia University, among other places, as well as Marshall University. I want to make sure I mention Marshall too. But we also want to take a little bit of a step back and look at really what's driving this epidemic in the first place. Because while this is not just the Office of Opioid Control Policy, it's the Office of Drug Control Policy, what is it that's driving the demand for drugs? And at the end of the day, this is a demand-driven problem. We often have focused in the past on supply-restricting solutions. Law enforcement interdiction are absolutely essential. But at the end of the day, it's really about how do we stop that demand and what are those factors? And so some of the things I carry forward from my previous job are looking at things like the social determinants of health, the things around the built environment, the economy, and something called adverse childhood experiences, which afflict many of the people who are using IV drugs, as we found out from our harm reduction clinic. And so all those things are going to be extremely important going forward. The other thing that I'm very much interested in are ways to deal with pain that don't involve medication. So non-pharmacologic pain management, which we know there are many very effective and useful ways that we can modulate pain or live with pain in a way that doesn't require prescriptions at all. That's a cultural shift. It requires a cultural shift among not only among providers, but among patients as well, because the expectation is, I'm hurting, I'm going to the doctor, I'm going to get a pill for my pain, when in fact, a lot of these other kind of modalities are very, very effective. We often call them alternative treatments, but that's just really good medicine to be able to bring the best tools available.
So you mentioned the new opioid response plan. Talk to me a little bit, how can West Virginians expect to see this impact their lives? And I mean, we talk about every family in West Virginia has been affected by this epidemic.
Well, we're going to be working, first of all, to expand the number of beds available. You know, the Ryan Brown program, just got a review of that today. There's expansion of the number of beds in West Virginia. A very exciting announcement from Highland Hospital that they're taking over the Sugar Grove Naval Facility that has been sitting dormant for the past 3 years and turning that into a recovery and treatment campus, which is will add 95 beds to begin with, and it will expand outward from there. It's really an exciting project. So that's one way that opioid response plan will be put into effect, is this expansion of treatment and recovery beds. Another way is the expansion of harm reduction, as we've talked about, because this helps reduce the risk that communities have for hepatitis B, hepatitis C. By the way, we lead the nation in hepatitis B. We're number two with hepatitis C, which is the number one infectious killer in the United States. Many of the viewers may not know that recently in the Center for Disease Control's MMWR, which stands for Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, they reported on an outbreak of HIV in southern West Virginia. And the counties in which they had the HIV outbreak did not have harm reduction with them. So that was very well contained. The Bureau for Public Health, working with the Centers for Disease Control, effectively contained that outbreak. But we also know that in Northern Kentucky, there's currently an outbreak of 40 cases of HIV, 20 of which are related to IV drug use. So we know that this is a real and present danger. We don't want to become the next Scott County, Indiana, where they had 200 cases in a county of 24,000 people, which will cost that county between $100 and $250 million. Those are only two of the small parts that I've talked about, the opioid response plan, expanding medication-assisted treatment. There's a lot of suspicion that we're substituting one drug for another, but medication-assisted treatment has shown to be extremely effective and has helped reduce people's cravings. It's not really to make them high. It allows them to function normally. People really talk about being able to return to a normal life on medication-assisted treatment, and that's our goal. We want to take the people who are currently afflicted by this epidemic, not only the people who are using, and make them back into productive citizens, but also to be able to take care of the families, to reduce the stigma around the opioid epidemic, and also to take care of our first responders, who are another population at risk, which that's not really part of the opioid response plan. you know, our population here are really, who are using, are really treated like modern day lepers because they're outcasts from society. And we need to get over this notion that this is somehow different than any other disease. These are people who need our help, and we need to provide compassionate care to these people.
Appalachia Health News is a project of West Virginia Public Broadcasting with support from Marshall Health, Charleston Area Medical Center, and WVU Medicine. Appalachian ginseng is a valuable commodity. A pound can go for several hundred dollars, but it takes a lot of work to gather a pound of ginseng. Poachers and thieves make it even harder. The West Virginia legislature recently voted to increase the fines for unlawfully digging the root. Eileen Guo spent a day in Scioto County, Ohio, with a grower who is taking protection of his crop into his own hands.
It's mid-October in Ohio, and I'm trying my best to keep up with the long strides of 70-year-old Tom Johnson. He's patrolling his tree farm, and he's armed with a .22-caliber semi-automatic rifle. But the weapon isn't for protecting his white oaks, poplars, or other hardwoods. He's worried about his ginseng.
I think it was 1989 when I first planted any ginseng. It really doesn't get good until it's maybe 10, 15, 20 years old. Then you have some valuable product. Last year I sold it for $425 a pound. I could have $40,000, $50,000. That would help retirement. Little did I know at that time that there were poachers.
The first time Johnson became a victim of poaching, he was attending a conference out of town organized by the nonprofit Rural Action.
And I can still remember this older guy standing up, and he said, "Boy, this would be a perfect time for your thieves to get in and steal." So I come home, and sure enough, there was an area probably 20 by 20 that looked like hogs had been in there. They dug everything.
Johnson tried everything to deter thieves.
About 200, over 200 signs.
What did they
say? No trespassing, no hunting, fishing. Put those signs up, they'll tear them down. Had cameras, you know, I got some good pictures.
But nothing worked.
I was thinking one day, if I were a thief, what would defer me from being on someone's property trying to steal the ginseng? And I thought, if somebody was up there shooting, I probably would think I'll go over to the next guy's farm.
Not that he's shooting at anyone.
I'm very, 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 very careful about what I shoot. I shoot dead trees. My intent is not to hurt someone. It's to let them know I'm there. I have a gun, and maybe they might want to move on.
But they don't always move on, at least not immediately.
I'll go up on a hill and at various times stop and shoot. I've had people shoot back. Didn't hit me. They heard me shooting and they were shooting back.
He used to call up the local sheriffs, but he's never been able to catch anyone red-handed.
My biggest mistake, I guess, was I didn't have them bring up their bags of ginseng. We never could find them. They didn't have any evidence. It was my word against theirs.
So the sheriffs just let them go.
And I don't blame law. And especially now in Scioto County, we have a lot of bigger problems than poaching ginseng.
The county is at the heart of the country's opioid crisis. Right next door is Portsmouth, known as the Pill Mill of America. In December alone, 33 people were indicted for their involvement in a drug trafficking ring.
If you have a drug habit, you can go out and steal my ginseng and get enough money to get you a fix.
But there's another challenge to prosecuting ginseng thefts. Law enforcement doesn't always know what to make of it, and even the word poaching is confusing.
Poaching, to me, is a kind word. It makes me think of eggs. But it's not. They're just stealing, not my corn, not my cattle. They're stealing my ginseng.
Over the years, the amount stolen really adds up.
I would estimate probably 10 times as much as I dug. I probably sold less than $3,000.
Ultimately, the ginseng thefts are about more than just his retirement money.
This is a heritage farm. My great-great-grandfather homesteaded.
That gives him a respect for the land and the root that the thieves don't share.
They don't dig it ethically and with the idea that next year they'll come back and get more. They dig it with the idea, I'm going to dig every plant. I don't care how small it is, I'm going to dig it. And I'm not going to plant the seeds back because I'll probably never be back this way again. In olden days, my grandfather, he knew how to dig it, planted the seed back. That way next year you can go back and still dig enough for your Christmas money.
It was his time in the woods with his grandfather that eventually sparked Johnson's interest in growing ginseng. But it's not a tradition that he'll be passing on.
I really would hesitate to have my granddaughters out in the woods with the poachers, the thieves that I've encountered. I don't think it would be wise.
So it's not just ginseng that's being stolen. It's also the opportunity for younger generations of Appalachians to learn about their heritage. And that might be the greatest loss of all. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Eileen Guo.
West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Our producer is Glennis Board. I'm Teresa Wills. This is WVPB Charleston, WVBY Beckley, WVBL Bluefield, WVPW Buchanan, WVWV Huntington, WVEP Martinsburg, WVKM Mate 1, WVPM Morgantown, WVPG Parkersburg, WVDS Petersburg, WVWS Webster Springs, WVNP Wheeling, and we're online at WVPublic.org. A winter storm warning in the eastern mountains until 2 o'clock this afternoon. Partly sunny in the eastern panhandle, cloudy elsewhere, a chance of snow with highs in the 30s.